agreement, the ceasefire agreement, or the cessation of hostilities that was announced in November 2024 on a daily basis. The Israelis do not stop killing people in southern Lebanon, targeting civilians, targeting civilian infrastructure in Lebanon, and they do not withdraw from Lebanon as was agreed in the ceasefire agreement. They have these five bases that they continue to expand. They also do not release the hostages that they took, the civilians that they kidnapped from Lebanon. And so therefore, why should the Lebanese actually upgrade its negotiations with them and turn it into a civilian, and include a civilian as the Americans and the Israelis requested, since the Israelis are not cooperating with the already in place ceasefire agreement? I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. It's not about like putting a strategy forward. It's about saying that the way the Lebanese government is acting is irresponsible and it is completely unjustifiable. Why would you send, upgrade your mission to the negotiation when the negotiating party that you're negotiating with is not respecting the already agreed to agreement? And the Israelis are trying as much as possible to eliminate the UNIFIL's role. They are condescending the United Nations. We Lebanon is a country that respects the United Nations. We are a founding member of the United Nations. We're supposed to abide by 1701 and the agreement that is from 1701, which is the agreement, the ceasefire agreement. Mm-hmm. The Israelis do not respect that in any way. They have been killing. They have killed more than 350 Lebanese since the ceasefire was agreed to. They have expanded their military bases, as I mentioned. This is totally unacceptable. And the Lebanese government seems to, go along. And the day they had this negotiation with the civilian, civilian ambassador on the Lebanese team, the next day, the Israelis bombed civilians in southern Lebanon. They bombed civilian home next to a hospital, and this was totally unacceptable. Mm-hmm. So there's no justification for
but
this kind
it
of...
Seems, Dr. Nasheb, it yes. seems that the two sides in Lebanon are on different poles here. Hezbollah maintains that only steadfast defense readiness can deter ongoing Zionist aggression and repeated violations, according to his experience. Meanwhile, Lebanese authorities argue that diplomatic engagement, including that latest openly very controversial move of sending a civilian representative to the proposed mechanism, can shield the country through dialogue. Which of these two paths is truly more capable of protecting Lebanon and restraining the Zionist Israeli entity?
Well, scientifically and logically, we're supposed to take a similar example to see how it turned out. So let's take Syria as a similar example. Let's take the Syrians and how they behaved, the new regime in Syria, how they behaved with the Israelis. The new regime in Syria told the Americans that they do not want to actually resist Israeli occupation of southern Syria, of the Golan Heights, which is a violation of Resolution 242 by the Security Council. Again, they said that they don't want to confront the Israelis. They said they're ready to give up their arms. They're ready to actually sign a peace agreement and do direct negotiations with the Israelis. And they actually participated in high-level direct negotiations with civilians with the Israelis. What happened? What happened is that the Israelis bombed the capital, Damascus, and they bombed, this was at the heart of the capital. The main square in the capital was bombed by the Israeli war jets. They expanded their occupation in southern Syria to Dar'a and to Jabal Sheikh, to Mount Hermon. They consolidated their occupation of the Golan Heights, which is an occupation since 1967. And they also announced a new corridor, which is called the David Road, all the way from the Golan Heights to the Qamishli. So this is how the Israelis actually respond to goodwill and to a kind of expression of readiness to sit on negotiating table on a high level. So I think the Lebanese should take some lessons from what happened with the Syrians and should know that, the Israelis do not understand this language of diplomacy and of peacemaking and negotiations. Every time you actually bow and decide to actually negotiate with them, they hit you harder and they violate international law even more, and they are just interesting of bullying the neighboring countries and make them abide by their own rules and their own decisions, and this is all in the interests of a greater mm-hmm. Israel, which they mean to expand from the Nile to the Euphrates, and they would do any tactic to achieve that.
With all that happening, Dr. Omar,
yes.
Cue in Thomas Barak. In what ways has decades of Western financial, political, and diplomatic pressure contributed to Lebanon's structural weaknesses? And how does this context challenge the narrative presented by figures like the U.S. envoy to Lebanon, Tom Barak, who called Lebanon, again, a failed state?
Yes, I'm glad that Ambassador Barak articulated this and said that Lebanon is a failed state. Lebanon has one of the largest U.S. embassies in the world. It has one of the largest French embassies in the world. Lebanon has all these American institutions in education, in health, in business. French and American institutions are all over the place. The Lebanese people are more educated sometimes in an American accent. More than the Lebanese, they know English better than they know Arabic. They know French better than they know Arabic. Everybody knows that. Lebanon and the Lebanese government has refused to receive any aid from Iran or from China to fix its economy. Lebanon has been under this American hegemony and this French hegemony all along. So, you know, describing it as a failed state is describing the United States as failed initiatives in Lebanon, describing the French as failed intervention in Lebanese affairs. You know, this is a total failure because of the Americans and the French and the Western powers, whereas there's not even electricity. You know, we still have electricity cuts, whereas Iran and China had promised and had offered, especially Iran, to fix the actual electricity system. The central government, because of American pressure, refused to accept that. That's just one example of many examples that explain how Lebanon is a failed state as described by Ambassador Thomas Barak.
Even Russia at some point gave some sort of a proposal for the government to help them try and get their oil and gas from their land and from their sea, and it was met with the big no-no from the United States of America. So how do you think that Lebanon can pull itself up from being a failed state while being bombed and while being looted?
I think what we need is national unity. We need less moves by the government that actually compromise national unity. We need solidarity with the people in the South who have been bombed, who are under the threat of Israel. That national unity, if it's achieved or if we achieve any progress on that level, I think that would be more important than any foreign help or foreign intervention in Lebanese affairs. The Lebanese are capable of defending their land if they are united. However, some Lebanese, unfortunately, are affected more by Western and external influence than by their own willingness to fix their country.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Omar Nashebe, political commentator and lawyer, expert in human rights, for explaining what is really happening in Lebanon because of the Zionist aggression and the U.S. hegemony. Thank you very much for your time and
thank
your contribution.
You.
Ladies and gents, stay tuned because next we are going to talk about the billions for endless Zionist wars.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Zionist Israel's cabinet has approved a staggering $35 billion U.S. dollars defense budget for 2026, signaling that war remains the cornerstone of its policy. As billions are poured into weapons and military infrastructure, the region braces for continued violence, while political scandals and corruption taint the leadership's credibility. More details in the following report.
While the world reels from the destruction inflicted on civilians, ravaged cities, and breaking humanitarian norms, Zionist Israel is doubling down. Its cabinet just approved a monstrous defense budget, $34 to $35 billion U.S. dollars for 2026. Yes, 112 billion shekels allocated to war, to weapons, to occupation, all under the excuse of security. Because this is about perpetuating war, about cementing Zionist Israel's role as the world is starting to call it a permanent aggressor, an entity armed to the teeth, ever ready for the next assault. A war-thirsty entity whose budgets are war chests, bills written in blood. Just last year, Zionist Israel reportedly spent $31 billion on military operations during its war on Gaza, Lebanon, Yemen, and Iran. And now, even as ceasefires are announced, the machinery of war is being rebuilt, bigger, stronger, more destructive. How can the world still claim Zionist Israel pursues peace when its leaders treat war as a perpetual business plan? When their answer to ceasefire is more bombs, more artillery, more soldiery, funded with billions. Let's call it what it is, a budget for atrocity. A financial plan for more bloodshed. A guarantee that Palestinians and all those resisting occupation will never know real peace. Only cycles of violence, despair, and ruin. And as Zionist Israel pours billions into preparing for the next round, there is internal rot. Reports swirl that its longtime leader Benjamin Netanyahu is scrambling behind closed doors, begging foreign patrons, including U.S. President Donald Trump, to secure him a pardon to save him from looming corruption trials. This, ladies and gents, is naked gangsterism. Leaders buying impunity with the same currency, bombs, they pawn on innocent lives. So when you see world leaders wringing their hands, when you hear calls for restraint and dialogue, remember, the real danger isn't the talk, it's the tanks, the jets, the check written for $35 billion, signed and sealed. Because Zionist Israel today is not a nation defending itself from danger. It is an entity that has made war into its identity. A war machine fueled by American taxpayers' money, now aiming to rebuild, rearm, and strike again. And the world watching, the victims watching, must call it by its name. Occupier, aggressor, and war criminal.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ali Hami, military strategist and political analyst. It's a pleasure having you with us. Dr. Ali, now, how does Zionist Israel's 2026 defense budget of a swooping $35 billion reflect its strategy priorities? And what does it really reveal about the state's reliance on military force rather than diplomacy?
As usual, we see that the budget of the Israeli military defense budget, it was $23 billion. Now we are talking about $35 billion for 2026, which means that this increase, I believe that to restore the military equipment and the infrastructures that been destroyed within the 2 years of war, and especially the 12 days that been a war with Iran, mostly the Israeli infrastructure were destroyed, and they need more defense budget to restore and to fill the gap of the soldiers also that been fighting for 2 years, as a new budget for them for a better life. This is from one side. The other side is to cover the expensive on the new land, occupied land in Syria. They need more budget to control such big area right now. And also maybe to implement new weapon and to implement also new demonstration on such new weapon.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it's a bit odd, given that there are certain ceasefires that are put in place. But in what ways does this massive military expenditure really affect the humanitarian and political landscape of the Palestinian territories in specific, and the broader region, including Lebanon, possibly Syria, possibly Yemen, and maybe Iran?
You know, now we are talking, let's say that GDP of the Israeli entity is $610 billion. And they used to spend like about 5% of their budget. Now it's increased by 3 or 4% more. I think it will affect the inside, let's say, civilian budget inside the Israeli entity, but it's it will make the military a little bit stronger. But we don't know yet how it can be, how it can have like some influence or more influence of what's going on war on against the resistance alliance, or how it can affect on Gaza. I think it will affect like more a new weapon, a new more massacres, destroy more demolition, and maybe it will be also to have more capability to stay within Gaza, or in case they want to have a new round of war.
Well, I want to talk about their internal politics a bit, but given what you just said, before we talk about the internal politics, that Zionist Israel is preparing itself, it's paying billions of dollars to prepare itself for upcoming wars, and yet you see on the other side the Lebanese government giving concession after concession, not paying a dime to increase the capabilities of the Lebanese army. And on the other hand, they are demanding the people who have the capability to give up their weapons. How can you explain that?
Well, we have to add also to the to this budget. We are talking about the military defense budget for the Israelis, which increased by like about $10 billion for that 2026. And we don't have to forget the support of the United States and the new every year free of charge equipment that coming from Germany to support also the Israeli entity. The Lebanese army has a small budget, defense budget, and they cannot be equipped with a new weapon to fight the Israeli entity. And also, if we consider the what so-called the American aid to the Lebanese military or army, we see it's like change only.
It's laughable. It's like they're laughing
pennies.
At us. It's like they're laughing at the army.
Exactly. And, you know, from this budget, they support the Lebanese army with old weapon, also old ammunition. They don't give us any military equipment that we can fight the Israeli entity with it. So they only, as Thomas Barak said,
all of that is being said, and then you have people like Tom Barak coming along to tell us in such a patronizing way that we are a failed state. And when asked, how is that even possible when you refuse to increase the capabilities of the Lebanese army and we see that the capabilities of the Israelis is increasing, he literally said that they would only help the army if they kill their own people. And then you
exactly.
still have the government people siding by the Americans while putting their own resistance on a red lock. What is that about?
You know, like we see that negotiations are going on now between the mechanism, two parties from Lebanon and from the Israeli entity, and supposedly the guarantor is the American General Clearfield. And we know that the Americans are the big supporter of the Israelis, and they support Israel with their offense against us.
I mean, we were bombed with U.S.-made weapons, and at some point, even American pilots took part in bombing us.
The Americans were participants, not only supporters. The Americans destroyed us with their own military, with their own, let's say, brigades that existed in the on the sea, Marines and Navy, and especially the Delta Force and Navy SEALs against Lebanon, using the U-2 and Camp Skull, and also MQ-9 and others, to and especially F-35 that had been sent, exported to the Israelis off shelf from the military, American military depot ahead of time. only to destroy us. Mm-hmm. But let's say in negotiation, they want to try to make Lebanon so weak without any playing card on the table of negotiation and to go as naked to the negotiation. They want to try to disarm Hezbollah, okay, and not to support the Lebanese army to have power to spread its authority all over the southern of Lebanon.
Well, everything you're saying is very important, but I have just one more minute and want to talk about the internal politics crisis inside of the Zionist entity, where Netanyahu's corruption trials and his appeals for foreign intervention is intersecting with Zionist Israel war-driven budget. I mean, he's begging Netanyahu for a pardon. How do you think that will affect the internal Israeli politics?
I think Netanyahu, since the what's so called the 20 pounds deal with Gaza and the 17 one with Lebanon, is trying to buy time and extra time and every time extra time just to stay in power and trying to have a special pardon from his president, but at least to declare that he was corrupt. I don't think he will do so. So he will try to buy time. Now he's adding a new budget to the military spending, and I think it will make the Israeli internal policy a little bit occupied with such dispute.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ali Hamiyi, a military strategist and political analyst, for joining us to talk about this matter. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, hello and welcome. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at some of the contents of Surah Ankabut. Now let's listen to 42nd and 3rd verses of this surah.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Inna Allah ya'lamu ma yad'un min dunihi min shay.
Indeed, Allah knows whatever thing they call upon other than Him, and He is the exalted in might, the wise. And these examples we present to the people, but none will understand them except those of knowledge.
So, dear listeners, in this verse, the Quran threatens and warns those negligent, unaware polytheists, and implicitly states that Allah knows whatever they call other than Him, because you may remember previously we were talking about the fact that these polytheists, these pagans, they actually associate with God somebody other than Him. They rely on somebody other than the Almighty Allah, both for their worships and their prayings and for their daily routine works. So here Almighty Allah says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَّمُ مَا يَدْعُونَ مِن دُونِهِ. Verily, Allah knows whatever thing they are calling besides Him. وَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الْحَكِيمُ. And He is the mighty, the wise. So, Quran is threatening these negligent polytheists. Now, neither their manifest polytheism nor their hidden one is concealed to Allah. And He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, is the mighty and the absolute wise. If He gives respite to them, it is not for the sake that He does not know or His power is finite, but His wisdom requires that He gives enough respite to them so that He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, completes the argument to all, and those who are eligible for guidance can be guided. إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُ مَا يَدْعُونَ مِن دُونِهِ مِن شَيْءٍ. Allah knows whatever thing they are calling upon besides Him. Some commentators have taken this sentence as an indication to the pretext that the polytheists sought for themselves. They used to say that actually, if they worship those idols, it would not be because of the idols themselves, and they were indeed some symbols of stars of sky and of their prophets and angels. They said, in fact, they said that they prostrated for them, they respected them. And in their and their good and evil and their benefit and harm are in their authority. This is what they stated. But the Holy Quran implies that Allah knows what things the polytheists call, whomever they may be, and whatever they may be, they are the likes of the web of spider, comparing to the power of His command, subhanahu wa ta'ala, and they have nothing to give them. They do not have any benefit for them, for the followers of them, and they do not actually give any kind of support. They are not refuge. So this was about the 42nd verse. إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُ مَا يَدْعُونَ مِن دُونِهِ مِن شَيْءٍ. Surely Allah knows whatever the thing they call upon besides Him. And it says, وَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الْحَكِيمُ. He is the mighty, He is the wise. Why? Because at the very same time that He knows, He is powerful as well. He can help you, He can support you. Just in contrast with what you have chosen as your gods, which is like a spider's weak house, أوهن البيوت, so-called. The power of the Almighty Allah is infinite. والعزيز الحكيم. And the next verse may refer to the rejection of the enemies of the Prophet ﷺ, who pointed to these parables and said that how is it possible that Allah, who is the creator of earth and heaven, brings forth parables to spider, fly, insects, and the like? This could be the case. This could be the occasion of revelation. وَتِلْكَ الْأَمْثَالُ نَضْرِبُهَا لِلنَّاسِ وَمَا يَعْقِلُهَا إِلَّا الْعَالِمُونَ. And such are the parables we set forth for mankind, but none understand them but the learned ones. So that's what this verse is about. The importance and tenderness of a parable is not in its being small or big, but it is in its fitness with the aim. I mean, the parable you provide, the parable you mention, the parable you set forth must suit with the context. And that's the point. Sometimes it's being small is its most important and most significant point of strength. For example, when the words are mostly about the weak and baseless supports, the parable must be chosen from spider, which can illustrate this weakness, this instability, this lack of resistance better than anything is. This lack of structure is shown only in this, actually, house. This is the identity of eloquence and elegance. That is why it is said that only the learned ones can recognize the elegance and elaborations of the Quran. وَمَا يَعْقِلُهَا إِلَّا الْعَالِمُونَ. Only those who understand them are the learned ones, the ones who actually try to understand, and they do not look at the verses of the Holy Quran as some very simple parables. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode as well. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, and that's when faith begins.
You raise your tired hands toward the sky, and the dark night lights up as you praise God. Your tears rain on your hijab and this cold air is filled with the fragrance of jasmine flower. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes, and heal the scars of our city with your sense of your necklace and
the only food in your home. You talk to God until the rising of the sun, and you forget yourself while praying for everyone. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes, and heal the scars of our city with your sense of heaven. Oh,
when you travel to a historical city, the goal is not just to visit museums and beautiful monuments, but you want to mix with the locals and learn about their traditions and culture. In recent years, many historical houses in Iran have turned to accommodation places, which are called Boomgardi. These are neither hotels nor hostels. They are local traditional houses that provide the opportunity for their guests to meet with locals and live like locals, even for a short time. Nartiti is the first house we visited, a beautiful place in the small town of Taft, with several traditional elements. An Iranian Zoroastrian couple owns the house. Traveling also means doing activities that we would not have done elsewhere. Each night, all the travelers who stay in this cozy place meet with the owners of the house, drink tea, and eat freshly picked pomegranate from the backyard. And so, they can experience a little different trip and realize that we all share the same fundamental values and same objectives. We're all part of the same planet, and this makes us stay connected.
Staying at these kinds of places adds to one's understanding of the world and understanding of people. It is something which gives you an understanding that all of us are the same. We're all people. We're much more similar than we are different. And when you start taking governments and other things out of the situation, it's just, we can enjoy being with each other and understanding each other and learning about each other.
Another differentiating element of this house is a wall full of memories of those who stayed a while in this place. A very interesting wall that takes you to a journey around the world.
Une nuit dans cette maison est particulièrement une expérience particulièrement enrichissante. enrichissante, puisque ça permet de partager ses expériences entre les différents voyageurs qui se croisent ici.
In Iran, when a guest or loved one leaves our house, we accompany him or her to the door and throw water to show we want him or her to return very soon. With this compassion, we left that beautiful place to discover other local guest houses. The second place is the House of Baran, which means rain in Farsi, a beautiful adobe house that truly represents the city of Yazd. A very simple house, but artistically decorated and perfectly designed with traditional Persian elements that constantly reminds you of the peaceful spirit of Iranians. A beautiful house with very positive energy. There's a logic behind the location of every piece in decorating this guest house. Some of these elements are symbolic and some others are still functional.
This house has lots of interesting features for me as a visitor. Abbas, the owner of this guest house, had to adjust the stairs and make them more comfortable for us, people of modern age, to be able to walk down. Because apparently, back in the old days, they were building these stairs very high. On the ground room, there is about 15 to 20 degrees Celsius temperature difference, comparing it to upstairs. So making it a perfect room to chill and maybe take a nap during the hot days of summer. Also during the cold days of winter, this is gonna be a very warm room and area of the building. Few steps down and this tiny little room even gets cooler. Ideal, perfect place to keep your fruits and vegetables during the hot days of summer. Natural cooling system. You know why? Because it's connected to the wind tower room.
There is always a time to say goodbye to even the most beautiful things in this world. What you take from that location or moment is usually what you see or experience towards the end. An unforgettable taste with a beautiful color and very exciting recipe create an experience that I will take with me from Baran Guest House. The exciting thing about all these traditional guest houses is the fact that they're all different in some ways. One is famous for its traditional elements, one is known for its design and decorations, and the other has some very moving stories about the people who lived there, the people who run it now, their families and their relatives. Local people of different regions of Iran, full of love and passion, the most hospitable hosts that I have ever seen in my life. Jahangard Guest House is one of the few places that you can have a unique experience of meeting local elders, hear their stories, and learn about their experiences.
One of the benefits of staying at local guest houses is to have a chance to have this first-hand experience of seeing local handicrafts being made. And I really enjoy interacting with these people, talking to them, and of course learning from them.
One thing is to hear or imagine how life was back in the old days, especially inside these gorgeous traditional guest houses. Another thing is to live the life of those people in those days. It might be some very simple acts, or even sometimes symbolic, but they definitely worth the try. It feels amazing. Shahryar Azimi for Iran.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good day to all of our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We have some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Let's listen to it. Consider to be a verbal revelation by Allah that is the actual word of God. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims, literally meaning the recitation. The Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Surah Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. The surah, which is consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions. Now we go for the translation of this holy surah. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, praised be Allah, Lord of two worlds, this world and the hereafter. The beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment, you alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. We start off this hour's programs with Round the World with Reporters. Listen to fascinating reports from all over the globe as reporters tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. They will be followed by Minbar. The program covers speeches on various subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. Then it's time for our varied radio productions feature. And our final program this hour is Quran Quest. If you want to know more about the Holy Quran, then this program is definitely for you. Stay with us for the next hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Again, 120 people were murdered in a massacre by the RSF militia as they attacked a kindergarten, a village and a hospital. Most of the dead were children aged 3, 4 and 5. The massacre against civilians had been conducted in the village of Kalogi in South Kordofan. Diplomats heard during the presentation of the new report on the humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
And sometimes the situation and the facts are distorted, so we want to shed light on the developments in the country, and also you know that now the UN is saying that Sudan is the largest humanitarian crisis, and so we would like to see why the situation is going in that direction, and what is the magnitude of this humanitarian crisis, and also what is the support that we can get from our partners in the international community.
The new report sheds further light on the UAE's technological and military assistance of the RSF militia. The report says that the shortest way to achieve peace and end the suffering of the Sudanese people is to hold the UAE accountable for its aggression. However, a recent EU Parliament resolution removed the mention of the UAE at the last minute.
The UAE are supporter of the RSF rebels, but after some diplomatic interventions by the UAE, the European Parliament opted to address, which is called on the world foreign countries that influence the conflict.
We will keep providing humanitarian aid to ease the suffering of the Sudanese people. Sustainable and safe delivery of humanitarian aid in Sudan remains to be an urgent need to ensure uninterrupted delivery of humanitarian aid.
On Tuesday, an aid convoy of the World Food Programme was attacked in Hamra El Sheikh in North Darfur. It was the 6th such attack this year that has so far led to the killing of 8 World Food Programme workers since the beginning of the year.
It's the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe. 30 million people are dependent on humanitarian aid, 15 million of them children. There are 10 million internally displaced people in the country. We're active in Sudan in principle and want to increase our efforts. But there are regions like Al-Fashir that are inaccessible to safe access.
Two unprecedented humanitarian crises, famine and genocide, have been unfolding in Sudan and Gaza.
Although witnessed by millions online, the international community remains unable and unwilling to stop them. Economic and political ties with the perpetrators and states supporting them, most notably the US and the UAE, seem to be more important than human lives in West Asia and Africa. Dieter Reinisch from United Nations in Vienna.
Iran is preparing to host a fresh and potentially decisive round of mediation between Pakistan and Afghanistan's Taliban regime next week, in what is being viewed as the most ambitious diplomatic effort yet to break the deadlock between the two hostile neighbors. The Tehran talks stand out due to the anticipated participation of China and Russia, signaling that leading regional powers now view the escalating Pak-Afghan rift as a direct challenge to wider regional stability. The Tehran initiative follows deadly border clashes between the two uneasy neighbors and earlier rounds of negotiations in Qatar, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, none of which produced a breakthrough.
This is a significant development, and what makes the Tehran talks particularly noteworthy is the expected participation of China and Russia. Their involvement signals that major regional players view this standoff between Pakistan and Afghanistan not just as a bilateral issue, but as a potential threat to wider regional stability. Tehran is leveraging both its political weight and the presence of two regional powers to create pressure for dialogue and compromise.
This mediation effort follows recent visits by Iran's senior security and diplomatic officials, reflecting Tehran's urgency to calm rising tensions between Islamabad and Kabul.
Since we have seen the Israeli occupation in Palestine and we have seen the atrocities of Israel, we have seen the very positive, very impactful role of Iran in the region. Iran has started maintaining its foreign relation with other and neighboring countries. So I believe that Iran this time could be a important mediator as compared to the other one, being in as I have already mentioned, that immediate neighbor, being a state, a stakeholder, so having projects with India, being a state. Because we have been blaming Afghanistan that their land is being used by India in creating proxies in Pakistan. So I believe this time we have a mediator that could play a better role than the previous ones.
In the run-up to next week's meeting, Iranian diplomats have intensified shuttle contact with both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
With tensions at their highest in years between Islamabad and Kabul, the Tehran mediation round will test whether coordinated pressure from Iran, supported by China and Russia, can open a path toward restoring trust and containing cross-border threats destabilizing the region. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Across the crowded western areas of Khan Yunis, tents stretch as fragile shelters held up by one essential material: wood. Yet even the simplest material is denied to Gaza's displaced families. Wooden pallets, once lying discarded on the roadside, have become a treasure for anyone desperate to keep a tent standing against wind and rain. That's what Rami Ibrahim understood. With his worn-out saw and a rusty hammer, he set up a small makeshift workshop, salvaging every splinter he could collect. From sunrise to sunset, Rami and his children worked together, cracking boards apart, pounding nails, and joining short pieces into long, sturdy supports, repurposing scraps into the pillars that can hold fragile shelters standing.
Most of us now live in tents, as no caravans or suitable housing units have arrived. While many people break down these pallets for firewood, I try to collect them from those who fetch them after aid or commercial deliveries. My children and I carefully transform these scraps into something usable. I even built my own workshop structure from this wood. As the weather grows harsher, at least when people lose their tents, they can find an affordable alternative.
Here in Gaza, wood has become a rare commodity, not for furniture, but for survival. With materials blocked by Israel, the scraps of wood recycled here are the only option for many displaced families to hold their tents from collapsing.
For the displaced families, the fear is no longer limited to Israel's bombs. Even the weather can tear their tents down. On a nearby road, Abu Ihab has just got a few wooden boards from the workshop. He lays them to rebuild a new tent after his previous shelter collapsed under the brutal conditions. With only a handful of boards, he hopes this rebuilt structure will withstand the winds this time, offering his family even a fragile sense of stability.
This isn't the first time I've used these wooden boards. They cracked during the last storm and caused my tent to collapse. Now, I got them again from a nearby workshop. But we really need stronger wood and tarps. What would truly help are proper housing units. Yet, they still haven't arrived, leaving us trapped in this endless cycle.
For Abu Ihab and countless others, the meaning of refuge has long been lost in the ruins of the homes Israel destroyed. No matter how many times they rebuild or reinforce their tents, the struggle remains the same. Families continue searching for materials or any form of proper shelter, but what they truly need remains out of reach as long as Israel blocks the entry of essential construction supplies. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis, Palestine.
Pakistan's capital Islamabad marked the International Day of Commemoration and Dignity of the Victims of the Crime of Genocide and of the Prevention of this Crime. A seminar was held bringing together former diplomats, members of parliament, think tank researchers, university faculty members, and students. Speakers reflected on historic and ongoing genocides targeting Muslim communities, saying Gaza today represents the world's gravest moral failure.
9th December, and by the United Nations, it's declared as the Genocide Prevention Day, and especially to pay respect to the victims of different genocides. I must appreciate all the people in South Africa and all the other different countries, those have showed their courage to support this issue and to support the people of Palestine, and especially the students of different Western universities. They supported this issue more.
Participants described the situation in Gaza as catastrophic, urging Muslim countries to stand united to defend the rights of the Palestinian people. They said nations like Iran, which have shown firm diplomatic resolve and a strong stance against Israeli oppression, can send a powerful message to the world.
I think it requires the realization and united action by the entire Muslim community around the world. It is not only some people who raise their voices and it is then forgotten. Well, Iran has taken a stand which is a beacon of light for all of us.
Meanwhile, a Muslim unity conference was also held on the outskirts of Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Participants from diverse backgrounds rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza, calling it a complete fraud.
The so-called peace promise made under Trump's leadership is nothing but a fraud. There is no ceasefire, the massacres continue, the genocide continues. Even the areas Israel was supposed to withdraw from remain under siege, and aid is still not reaching the people.
The participants emphasized that Gaza has become a defining test for the Islamic world, urging Muslim nations to take a united stand against occupation, injustice, and genocide of Israel.
Public anger keeps growing across Pakistan as the Israeli genocide in Gaza continues unabated amid international silence. Many fear that without global action, the catastrophic humanitarian crisis will intensify. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was observed at the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa compound in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa. A ceremony was held on Tuesday, bringing together representatives from the UN, the African Union, and ambassadors from various countries. The event highlighted decades of suffering faced by the Palestinian people, both in Gaza and the West Bank.
The Palestinian people's suffering has intensified under decades of a belligerent Israeli occupation, which has relentlessly targeted our land, the people, and every aspect of life in Palestine, culminating in an atrocious genocide in the Gaza Strip, confirmed by numerous UN and international human rights reports.
Injustice also continues in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, with Israel